a wonderfully perverse pleasure to be here in a little pocket of Germany in Belgravia to talk about an Italian opera that nobody has seen, unless, of course, anybody here was in Braunschweig in 2011. The story of Isabeau is one of decades of transalpine influences, leitmotif, intermezzo, and the Tristan chord, though we will not be hearing the Tristan chord tonight. Tonight we're here to talk about a centerpiece in this very peculiar opera. It's a centerpiece in which nobody actually sings. It's an orchestral depiction of the ride of the heroine naked through the city and the castle at the command of her father as a punishment for chastity. In 1891, the German premiere of Mascagni's first opera, Cavalleria Rusticana, still his best known one. Hans Merian, a critic of Die Gesellschaft, wrote, "Mascagni belongs to us. He is, in the full sense of the word, a modern artist." In 1905, Mascagni declared, "I feel myself profoundly Wagnerian, while in spirit and form I remain more than ever Italian." 1909, on the point of falling in love, he conducted Tristan und Isolde. So what we have in the opera that we're discussing tonight is a sort of melding of extraordinary influences. And to start off, I would like to invite Donald MacLeod, who's probably got the best ears in the business and knows more than he would care to admit about this, to talk about Mascagni, the man.
I thought it would be helpful, given that we haven't seen this opera and that Mascagni's operas, with the exception of Cavalleria, are not performed very often, just to fill you in a little. I apologise that I almost have my back to you. On what sort of a chap this was, just to give you a kind of sketch of what sort of life this man had. So, picture the scene, if you will, a chilly attic with peeling plaster, two struggling young artists who are in such dire straits that they share each other's clothes, and when it's really cold, they have to wear every stitch they have. It's a bohemian life. They constantly have to make up stories to fob off the landlord and various other importunate people who come to ask them for money, which they don't have. But at least down in the square below them is the Osteria dell'Aida. It's a not particularly flashy restaurant. Occasionally they can afford to eat there, but mostly they eke out the day with cups of coffee huddled by the stove for warmth. The name of the restaurant will have told you that this scene is set not in Paris, but in an Italian city. In fact, it's Milan, where two music students, Giacomo Puccini and Pietro Mascagni, are sharing a flat together. Out of this time, a friendship developed and a rivalry too, so that for Puccini's Orientalist fantasy, Madame Butterfly, we have Mascagni's equivalent, Iris, which I'm sure some of you in the room will have seen performed at Opera Holland Park in 2016. Pietro Mascagni's librettist on Iris was Luigi Illica, who provided the words for La Bohème, and he's also the librettist for this opera, Isabeau. The fact is, I guess, that with the exception of two people in this room, Michael Volpe and James, most of us know hardly a note of Mascagni's music apart from Cavalleria Rusticana. And it was that revolutionary opera representing a kind of raw peasant life which propelled Mascagni to explosive stardom. And this was rather fortunate. This was just at the point when Verdi was retiring into old age and people were looking for a successor. During his lifetime, Mascagni became one of the most famous people on the planet. He made the cover of Time magazine in 1926, holding a pack of cards and smoking a very expensive cigar. In that image, you have quite a lot of the essential Mascagni. Yeah. His fame spread worldwide, and this little kind of film that I'm unrolling for you cuts to May 1911, and the camera pans along the quayside in Buenos Aires, where 50,000 people turn up to welcome the ship which has brought Mascagni to their shores to conduct a season of his own operas, including the premiere of Isabeau. The police had to make a way to allow the car to pass through the crowds of many thousands who were lining the streets beyond. In his lifetime, Mascagni saw the rise of fascism in Italy. He lived through two world wars, and his fame came to an end with the fall of Mussolini from power. It seems probable that he was a manic depressive. I think that's probably what we'd call him now. He constantly sought out conflict and controversy, but then that's what his fellow Italians say about people who come from Livorno, that they're always looking for a fight. And so he was born over the family business, the Panetteria Mascagni. His dad was a baker, and his dad wanted, the assumption was that the eldest son would become a member of some profession, but he wasn't that bright. So he inherited the family business and was trained as a baker, and it was decided that Pietro would become a lawyer. When it became obvious to his father that was not what he had in mind for himself, he took to locking the boy in his room so he couldn't go to his music lessons. At a certain point, a benevolent uncle intervened and paid for the first performance of Mascagni's first major work, a cantata called Infilata. He tried to study in Milan, but it really didn't work out for him. He wasn't the academic type, so he joined a rather amazing kind of Vincent Crummell's outfit called the Castagnetti Forli Operetta Company. It was a pretty ropey outfit, a series of one-night stands in more ways than one, I suspect. And eventually he shipped up in Cerignola, in now fashionable Puglia, but then deeply unfashionable. It wasn't much of a place, but it had a decent theatre. And for some reason, the mayor of the town took a shine to Mascagni and made things happen for him. And it was while he was working in this Italian backwater that he created the work that would change his life and the history of Italian opera. The key figure here is the publisher, Edoardo Sonzogno, who had... he wanted to create a reputation for himself, and he'd done that by setting up a competition 5 years earlier, won by Puccini with Le Villi. 5 years on, he wanted to see if he could do the same thing by unearthing new talent, and this was the competition for which Mascagni submitted Cavalleria Rusticana. He eventually was summoned by telegram to go to Rome for an interview with Sonzogno, who told him, "I don't expect much of this opera. You're a fine composer, but your opera just isn't theatrical. But let the public judge for themselves." And as we now know, the public judged that this was exceptional. There were 60 curtain calls on the first night, and overnight his image was absolutely everywhere. I guess the it's rather interesting in the context of this piece that the most famous piece of Cavalleria Rusticana is voiceless. It's the intermezzo. 50 years after the premiere of the opera, the critic Guido Panain wrote of the kind of seismic effect of hearing the music for the first time. It was like a door that suddenly blew open into a sealed room. A fresh, cool wind from the country blew away the faint smell of mildew that was beginning to spread. It was a furious exaltation of song. The public heard their own voice in it and were overwhelmed. So he managed to follow this up with another not quite so successful opera called L'Amico Fritz. And he developed with this overnight fame plainly an absolutely monstrous egotism. He was an extremely difficult man to deal with. The critical response to the fiasco of his opera Le Mascheri unleashed a real torrent against him. Mascagni noted that more than one writer had expressed the hope that a vacuum be formed around me, that not one more note of music be written by me, that all my work, which is not entirely unfruitful and sterile as far as Italian theatre goes, might fall into inexorable oblivion. The following year, he was 46, and perhaps a sign of a midlife crisis. He began an affair with a chorus girl at the Costanzi Theatre in Rome. She was called Anna Lolli, and it's quite likely, given the kind of life he'd had, that this was not the first affair he had, but it was no mere fling. It lasted 35 years, and Anna became his muse, absolutely indispensable to him. And it is exactly at the point, the white heat of this affair igniting, that Mascagni composed Isabeau. I think at this point we ought to hear, remarkably, the intermezzo, which depicts the crucial moment in the opera.
I'd like to invite Michael Volpe, our general director, to explain Opera Holland Park's long relationship with Mascagni now. In the context of that, what was it that first attracted you to Isabel? Oh,
well, if you're going to have to get naked, that's the music to do it to, I suppose. James and I have had a long relationship with Mascagni. This will be our fifth, I think, is that right? Fifth Mascagni opera after Iris, L'Amico Fritz, Zanetto, Cavalleria Rusticana, Edith Sotsed, and this is the fifth. And there are lots more we'd like to investigate doing. The thing about Mascagni for us, I think, is that he's a familiar name, as Donald pointed out, that if we say he's the man who wrote Cavalleria Rusticana, and of course you know immediately what that means, and the musical language that you've heard there, although it's absorbed an awful lot of the, as Anna pointed out, the sort of looking to the north towards the Wagners and the Strauss, I suppose our journey has been inexorably with these works by composers in what was known as the Giovanni Scuola, the young school, that said we'd like a new language, and that is taking some of the German sentiment and aesthetic of Wagner and Strauss and adding a bit of Italian lunacy. And I suppose by around 1920, that sort of they came around the circle, and it was called in a great book, the Autumn of Italian Opera. Mascagni, he was a bit of a chameleon. He liked to sort of adapt himself to whatever was happening at the time. And as Donald said, he wasn't a man with humility, but he wrote some incredible operas. His gift for melody and his gift for orchestration was extraordinary. So we've found ourselves very much linked to Mascagni, and our journey is towards that great German tradition, and we're doing our very first Strauss this year in Ariadne auf Naxos. So it all makes sense. But Isabeau, it's wonderful to be able to present the premiere in this country. And last year, the year before when we did Iris, we had Mascagni's granddaughter in attendance. That's really why Mascagni for us, and why, as many of our panel have pointed out and will point out, we're here tonight, because there is this very much a great link. And I'm glad that you've all come, and I'm glad that you all continue to explore this repertoire with us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. I'd like now to move to Professor Linda Need, Herbstreit Professor of History of Art at Birkbeck College, author most recently of The Tiger in the Smoke, Art and Culture in Post-War Britain, but also of the seminal study. Is that fair? Can we use that word in this context?
I don't know. Yeah, okay.
The Female Nude, Art, Obscenity, and Sexuality, which we were discussing earlier. It was possibly the first female gaze on what was traditionally something that was only looked at by the male gaze. None of us know this opera, of course, but it is about a woman who is nude in this central tableau. What are we doing here? Is it celebration? Is it shaming? It's set up as a punishment within the opera. Could you please give us a bit of context about the whole Godiva myth?
Yeah, thank you very much. And it's intriguing to be here, because it's such an interdisciplinary panel, because if you'll allow me, what I want to do is make some general comments about some of the ideas and concepts that are involved in staging a subject of this kind. And I mean staging or framing or composing, whatever we do, and why these concepts continue to trouble and disturb. So the kinds of concepts I'm thinking of are nudity, shame, censorship, obscenity, all of these related ideas which define what is and what is not acceptable. And I think they are troubling because they mark a sort of intersection where culture and sexuality come, if you'll excuse the phrase, up against each other. So it's a moment where two areas of human life are really brought together in a way that can be controversial, and it will really depend on who's doing the looking. So I'm sure even within this room, if we were to take a sort of census of what offends us and what doesn't, we would find, even with it quite a homogenous group, quite a variation of values and attitudes. And the point, first point I want to make is that it's not just about what's shown or what's in the image. Content is not really what's at stake here. It's about who is looking and the context in which they're looking and where they're looking. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a second, because I'm going to use a little case study to make these points. My interest is the female body and the visual arts in the second half of the 19th century, and the very particular ways in which purity, shame, obscenity, nakedness, nudity all come together in images of the female nude. Because they change. Not only do we have different attitudes at any one moment, prevailing ideas about what's acceptable and what is not acceptable are also historically specific and will be affected by what's going on in the world around us. So I'm just going to show you an image. It's by John Everett Millais. It's the Pre-Raphaelite painter. It's 1870. It's in Tate Britain. Millais is not known for the nude, so why would he paint it? He'd paint it because the body, when it is treated by high art, and I think this is pertinent to opera, is the most elevated subject that a creative can take and can make art out of. But it's very risky, because if you don't treat it properly, if you don't elevate your audience, if you arouse your audience, you're going to get into trouble. And what I want to look at is the way that Millais handled this subject. It's a big painting. The figures are almost life-size. And it was exhibited at the Royal Academy Summer Show in 1870. It's this large composition. It's divided in half by the tree trunk. On the left-hand side is a woman, a nude, very, very generic, conventional nude, in that what you see is the kind of optimum pose of a frontal breast and a profile breast. It's almost as if you've got the three graces in one. And of course, the most striking thing is the hair. This long, long hair, again, Lady Godiva, you know, bear that in mind. Long, long hair and the hairlessness of her body. On the right-hand side of the composition, you've got the knight, who is using the sword to break the ropes that have tied her to the tree. And he's got this rather beautiful sculptural face and the suit of armour. The figures are located in this rocky wood, and if you look right at the top right-hand corner, you can see the two little figures running away, right in the top right-hand corner, and at her feet are her clothes. So what is really unusual about this subject is that there's a reference to sexual violence. That the knight errant is saving this damsel from what would have been or could have been, which is troubling too, a sexual assault. So the two parts of the canvas really represent masculinity and femininity, nakedness versus the suit of armor and the metal, the hard surface versus the soft flesh, and the helmet versus the hair. So it's a really extraordinary and very striking large painting. And it was exhibited at a very controversial moment, a moment of social purity movements in Britain at this time. Music halls were being closed down. Newspapers and journals were also being closed because of their sexual content. So any image, any performance goes into an environment in which ideas will impact on the way that it's received. And what really worried the critics when they saw this painting was not the knight, he was fine, it was the figure of the woman. And what they sort of were worried about was the way she looked. That in fact she seemed like she should be wearing clothes. She wasn't a nude, a high art nude. This was a woman who should have her clothes on. They talked about her face in detail. And that's odd because we can't really see her face, but her face was cut out by Millet. This is the original face of the woman in that painting. So if we try and transpose that face onto that body, that's what the painting would have looked like. And you can see that we begin to have a face that a critic can read into. You know, it doesn't matter what she actually looks like. There's a face there that the critic can be offended by. And you can see this kind of language. The lady here bound to the tree is scarcely chaste as unsunned snow. We seem to wish that she would put on her clothes. And that because she evidently has been in the habit of wearing clothes. What has happened here is that Millet has failed to contain all of the connotations of the sexualized female body. He has failed to turn her into a female nude, and therefore the critics get really agitated and unhappy about it. So in any painting, I'm just going to wrap things up now, any painting, performance, anything where the body should be turned into high art, there is a risk. It can be celebration, it can be censure. I want to finish with a painting of Godiva by Edwin Landseer. I'm probably painting the horse as much as the female nude. But of course, what also, the most important thing is what happens to you. What do these paintings and performances do to you? If they elevate you and delight you and make you reflect and contemplate the values of high art, it's fine. If you get turned on, it's not so good. And I just want to finish with another image of Godiva. This is from the middle of the 19th century. It's Pilkington. And it was a gift. It was a gift from Queen Victoria to Prince Albert on the occasion of his birthday. So the whole Godiva, the knight errant, they're really mise en scène, they're fantasies. And it's really what happens to the viewer of these objects.
Thank you very much. I'd like to bring in Julie at this point, recently described as the UK's most controversial feminist. I'm thinking about Isabeau. It's one of those operas in which it's almost impossible to imagine a gender swap, isn't it? What's going on here?
Well, and if we did, it would be meaningless because we live in a context of, and I'm terribly sorry, everyone, I am the feminist. Well, I'm not the only feminist. What I mean is I'm the classic feminist in that I'm going to use the term patriarchy. So we live in a context of patriarchy. And it was fascinating to hear you speak about art and the context and who's looking, because this is, I think, feminism's very tricky relationship to opera. It is definitely a contradiction to be an opera lover and a feminist, but definitely not a problem for me, because I just love the music and I then rage in the cab on the way home about the plot and why does she have to die at the end. And there's a couple of things that I want to say, and not specific to Isabeau, but I think specific to the tension between those of us that fight a campaign against sexual violence towards women and girls by men, as we've seen a little snapshot of in its depiction in the previous presentation, and also how the some of the kind of feminist quest to subvert these misogynistic plots within opera, I think, are pointless. Because we have them, they are what they are. They are representative of, I would argue, the misogyny of the person who wrote the opera, the misogyny of society at the time. And we still, I would say, live in very misogynistic a context. So, for example, I mean, I came to love opera for its ridiculousness and its excess and the passion, and how if I was feeling sad about something and couldn't bring myself to cry, I knew that I would be able to sit and just sob and blame the opera. I'm very cathartic like that. But I think I also came to love it because of, rather than in spite of, the messages about women and sexual violence and misogyny and sexuality that is inherent to it. For example, the first time that I saw Madame Butterfly with its absolutely beautiful music and the terrible message that is that women are masochists who will fall in love with the men who abuse us. It's in Mills and Boone novels. It's in low culture, it's in high culture, it's in popular culture. And so it's just yet another vehicle. And so opera is not misogynistic. Opera is representative of its context and of its writers. However, I'm now going to say just a couple of things about what really winds me up. Right. So I'm not an expert on opera. You know, my expertise is feminism in just the controversial sort, not the fun sort. My two pet hates. Operas where men have to kill women because they're unfaithful. And the audience is encouraged to feel sorry for them. Okay, start with Carmen. And I mean, looking at some of the contexts in which I've seen Carmen, where it's set in a brothel, on a double-decker bus, wherever. But either way, you can't remove the fact that Carmen is seen as a whore and she's punished for being a whore. And then, of course, the chaste women are punished for being chaste. It's all the same thing. It's like the burqa and the bikini. It's all exactly the same thing. It doesn't actually matter whether or not, in one sense, we're naked or we go out on a slut walk celebrating how slutty we are and baring our breasts, or if we walk around in a nun's habit. Because if we end up in court, if we've been raped, we'll still have the same shit thrown at us. Do excuse my language, but it's the best way to describe it. So the current fashion that I've been noticing in the last 3 or 4 years is where rapes and sexual violence is introduced to operas that were not there in the original form. Mm-hmm. And they're brought in as entertainment. They actually mean nothing at all, and totally unnecessarily, because I do actually think that we need to see the reality of sexual violence towards women. I don't believe that we should hide it away, and I'm certainly not offended at the depictions. I'm offended when it's brought in unnecessarily, with no context and no solution to it, and no resistance by the women. So this is what I want to think about when I think about opera and sit on such an esteemed panel and amongst you all who know far more about opera than me. Carmen and Madame Butterfly, the two examples I always think are extremely negative in their image of women, because the stories focus on women losing their power due to their relations with men, due to their sexual desires and their relationships to men. And this is, for me, far more important than deciding whether or not the nude or the female form would be offensive or cause such controversy. I think we need to get to the root of what these particular narratives within the operas that I've mentioned tell us. This, to me, is a naked body, but also to the audience, it's what happens to women when they don't have sex with men when they're required to, or when they do have sex with men because they desire to. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Julie. There are about 30 points I'd like to come back to on that, as I'm sure many people would. Thanks. Kate, I was thinking back again to the image that Linda showed us, this armoured man, the chained woman. I was also thinking about the bells that we hear in the intermezzo, in Isabeau. The music could be almost created to be actually a kind of cloak for Isabeau, some sort of golden mantle. But what we keep rubbing up against is this idea of, are we looking at, is it about arousal? Is it about admiration? Are we looking at high art? Are we looking at low art? You have just curated this magnificent exhibition on opera, art, power,
passion,
power and politics. Everything has to have three names after it. And you're about to go into something on censorship. Having worked in this particular area, how much of an issue is the arousal thing? Is opera high art? Is opera low art?
That's a good question. I think in terms of censorship, opera often escapes the censor because it goes back to the stories that are acceptable. So there's definitely a way with opera where it takes on a status of high art, and it maybe things come out, I'm thinking historically, more in opera than they would, say, for example, in theatre. So in my presentation that I'm going to show you, I am going to draw some links, because that's what curators do, build some bridges between the opera and its context, because for me, having just curated the Passion, Power and Politics exhibition, it was placing these premieres in their context, which kind of made them so exciting and understandable, but also always thinking about them in terms of their contemporary relevance, which is obviously what opera companies do or can do so brilliantly today, is to say, why is this opera still relevant now? What was relevant about it then, and what can we take from it today? So if I just whiz you through some images, because it might be nice to look at some pictures as well. So I just want to introduce a few contexts, some of which have already come through in the panel's presentations. The context of Isabeau in 1911 is fascinating for many, many reasons. Looking at the obsession with the female nude, the fin de siècle obsession, and how that moves from opera to visual arts to theatre, from Salome to Pygmalion, thinking about how this was a kind of escapism from society. Then also looking at this, the context of 1911. This is the time of the first Women's Day. So you have this sort of Victorian escapism through the 19th century, the representations of the nude. But actually, what we're talking about in 1911 is the first Women's Day. I'm afraid I don't know an enormous amount about what the situation was like in Buenos Aires. But if this had been premiered in Germany or Italy, this would have been the year of the first marches and the first demonstrations. So I think that's sort of fascinating to think about that context. I also think the context of Freud is fascinating. And this is something that we drew links to with the Salome section in the exhibition. And I'm sure there's a lot. But I'm sure Mascagni would have been aware of Freud's studies. And apparently Freud's favorite dream was being naked in a public space. So say no more. And then just to think a little bit about nudity and sexuality in opera and in censored operas. Now, I've focused here on Tannhäuser, because Tannhäuser's premiere in Paris was, as we know, booed after three performances. And largely that was because the ballet scene that Wagner had to introduce for Grand Opera in Paris was he put it at the beginning because that made sense of the music. So he put the ballet scene at the beginning of the opera, but the Jockey Club were still having their dinner and they've missed the opportunity to see the dancers because they were waiting for act, it usually was in act three or four. So they were horrified and booed Wagner. So although these dancers weren't nude, the idea that the audience were there to see the dancers in this way was interesting, and then how that impacted on the opera is thought-provoking. I thought it was worth showing an opera, a direction of Tannhäuser, which is staged by Robert Carson, where women and men were naked. So the idea that whether you decide that Isabeau is naked, but the men are also naked, maybe there's new ways of doing it in Holland Park this summer. Obviously, we can't not think about Salome here. 1905 was the premiere of Salome in Dresden. The play was famously banned. The opera was censored in Berlin and Vienna for its biblical themes. But the Dance of the Seven Veils obviously has much controversy. And just thinking here about three different productions of Salome and what that makes us think in terms of nudity on the stage in opera. The image on the left is David McVicar's production, where he decides not to have the Dance of the Seven Veils. So that's interesting in itself. He removes it from the ballet, from the opera, when it's often the most revered scene. The top right is from a Met production, which went full on nudity for Salome. Was it needed? Bottom image is actually from a Wieland Wagner production from the 60s, which is interesting thinking about theatre censorship. Was the first fully naked Salome after 1968. So just thinking about different interpretations of Salome. And it would be wrong not to mention Elektra at this point, because I think we can draw lots of links between Elektra as a strong woman, and thinking that these premieres are what's happening in Europe. In Buenos Aires, we have Isabeau, which is looking at something very, very different for that society, which at the time is trying to present itself as a leader, as the country of Argentina is using opera in a way, using opera in the city to promote its confidence internationally. And then just jumping forward 50 years to the Censorship Act in 1968. So I think it's interesting to think that we're 50 years since the Censorship Act, which was passed in the UK to give freedom of basically an act of theatre, which removed censorship in the theatre in 1968. We're celebrating all sorts of things around that. At the V&A, we have an exhibition coming up. But thinking that here in 2018, we're 50 years since then, that 68 was 50 years since the Isabeau premiere, and this kind of consideration of the first musical, which was opened after the Censorship Act, which was Hair, which had obviously nudity on the stage, then led me to think about actually questioning the original narrative of Lady Godiva, and looking at the context of the original story, where Lady Godiva is rides through the through the city of Coventry naked, but it's a sign of protest. And I think that was in my mind as I was sort of drawing on this information about Hair and considering how Godiva was perhaps not so far away from the 1968 protesters, and that maybe that was an interesting to think about for the context of Isabeau today. And then I will finish on an image which is totally off-piste, but came out of thinking about nudity and protest. And this Spencer Tunick installation happened in Ohio at a Trump convention. And we have 100 women protesting against Trump, holding their mirrors up, reflecting their protest onto the Republican center. So I think I should probably finish there. So I just wanted to open your mind to some themes, some contexts, some relevances, and some questions.
That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you very much. Thanks very much. So we've got ideas of agency, and we've also got evolving ideas of what is saucy. Is it a tiny glimpse of leg? I think the earliest account of Godiva, it mentions the whiteness of her legs. So you've got the hair. James, I'd like to introduce James Clatton, our director of opera, to talk about staging the unstageable.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Anna. Thank you, everyone on the panel. I don't want to duck the question immediately, but first of all, in opera we work, and in all theatre really, but in opera particularly, we work in a state of heightened or stylized reality all the time. It's never a documentary film. It's never a real piece of cinema verite or whatever. What we try and do is work on images and imagination. I've lost count of the times over the years when people have said to us, oh, you can't, La Vallée, how are you doing the avalanche? Isabeau, how are you doing the horse ride? It just becomes very simplified and often takes over the entire thing if we treat it like that rather than as part of the story. When we get to this point, we really want you to be listening to that lovely piece of music and also following our story through, not all thinking, oh, she's nice or whatever. I think it takes away. So we try and draw a line where we can use it with imagination. Even in this piece, there's another tricky one for us, which is the hero, the tenor, the male hero is a Falco, who has a falcon that comes to his every call. So to be honest with you, the nude ride is not my biggest problem in this show. So it was only when I realised we're doing this tonight that it came up my list of problems. So we've got this falcon to arrive on the tenor's hand every time he calls him. But I think that as has been proved with, and I'm not saying this is what we're doing, obviously, but as has been proved in probably the most successful theatrical production of the last 20 years with War Horse, things can be made in a more theatrical and imaginative way than just giving it to everyone as they see it. So I think that we've done that with our La Vallée years ago. We used a series of pulleys on a massive sort of sheet that created this thing, and everyone said, I don't know how you did that. It was not just giving in to this is what we have to do. Personally, I think that with the nudity as well, on a purely purely practical basis, I have to say that it's not really for me on stage. I think it takes over anything about the production. And also on a really practical thing, to ask the soprano to do this scene is just another difficult layer for her to do, and she's got a lot of work to do that night. So we're still working on what we're doing with it, but I can say it's probably going to be, it will be a stylized version. And I think that it comes out of what we want to do with a design and how we treat it with the performers with respect, how we treat the audience with respect, and the story. I don't think I've ever put anything on stage that's purely being gratuitous just to make an effect. I don't think I've ever done that. If I have, it hasn't been deliberate. But I think that we'll look at it and just judge it. And I think that after hearing everyone tonight, I think we're going back to the drawing board and starting again with what we're what we're going to do. So that's it for me. I think that we're looking forward to it. I think it's a fantastic piece. And Michael and I, as Mike said, we've been working on these pieces for a long time. And for me, one of the great things is that when you all, not only the people in this room, but most audiences come to see a Carmen or a Don Giovanni, most people come in, even unintentionally, they come in with I call it the movie in their mind, the CD in their head, they know the tempi, they know what they want to expect. Excuse me. The great joy of these pieces is it's almost like having a new piece every time, and that when we get criticized sometimes for updating things, we did L'Amore de Tre Re in 2007. We updated it by over 1,000 years, but no one took a blind bit of notice because they just didn't know the piece. And so I think from our point of view, my particular point of view in my job, having an unusual and unknown piece gives me an absolute freedom with the director and the creative team to create something and to really just treat you as the premier audience. So it's a lovely thing for us to do. So I hope you all come and see it. It's going to be fantastic. We've got a fabulous cast, and thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
James, I have a solution to the falcon problem. It's a supply of day-old chicks, brutal but true.
Oh. dear me. Do we have any questions from the floor, or has anybody else got anything else they would like to come back with? Hello.
A humble but enthusiastic supporter of Holland Park Opera. I live around the corner, so it's not difficult.
Great.
Just on that last point, an interesting one, because I was going to ask why we hadn't mentioned Folco and the original, the genesis of his role, which of course was Peeping Tom.
Well, Peeping Tom, as I understand it, is a 16th century addition to the tale. He wasn't there in the original story at all.
This is in the nature of fairy tales and narratives, is that they don't stay the same.
Mm.
And when they're very powerful, symbolic stories, you know, they take on. They accrue characters and additional symbolism. And the thing that's so interesting about Godiva is the nature of voyeurism, isn't it? Because you weren't meant to look. And the introduction of Peeping Tom and then the way that that character is then twisted in the opera is what's so very interesting. And I keep thinking, you know, while I've been sort of thinking about this, of, I don't know if some of you know, the wonderful film by Powell and Pressburger called Peeping Tom, which is about the camera as a kind of voyeurism, as the Peeping Tom. And that's really powerful. It's like it's a really shocking additional twist to this Godiva story, is that Peeping Tom is actually the technology. It's actually you. You know, you're the ones who are going to decide what to do about Godiva and how you're going to try and treat your audience. And I think that's what's really so interesting. It's the most interesting thing for me, is how you're going to solve that. Especially with all that music.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it's fruity, isn't it? And then you're kind of, now it's going somewhere else. And that's a lot to take, isn't it?
He was enormously emotional. And the intermezzo that, as you said, it was about his lover.
We can't know it's about his lover. I mean, that whole autobiographical thing, I think, is just something we put to one side, because it's about a production and audiences and performers. You know, so it's much more than,
sure,
you know, what we want to make of, sure, his relationship.
Gentleman behind you.
Thank you for a very, very interesting discussion. I don't know very much about this piece, but I understand that Falco is blinded in a bout of fury by the citizens of the town. So, in other words, the citizens all agree to look away and not see her, but Falco does see her, and they become very vengeful and blind him. So the man who does see the naked woman is punished by the crowd in a very violent way. So there's another element to this, about another kind of anger and another kind of shockingness about it, is the shock of the violence of the crowd, prompted by someone witnessing the nakedness of a woman who they revere. So this is not just about her nakedness, this is also about the response of the crowd.
So yes, he is punished by the crowd. On the other hand, he is also rewarded by Isabeau because she falls in love with him. So, opera. lady.
Yep.
Sorry, lady over there.
Fairly controversial to turn it round, in that she has the power. She is empowered. She knows what those idiots are thinking, in a way. You know, that she can stand there. She can sit there. She is in the nude. And yet she is manipulating them, because she can, if she has the confidence to do it, she can look at them and think,
That's an extremely interesting point, but of course we actually don't know what she thinks, because all she says is so be it. She to accept it, not in the sense of accepting a challenge in the way that Godiva does, she accepts it in the sense of accepting an order. Julie, did I detect that you were bubbling to sort of...
Well, I do hear this term empowerment a lot, and it's never about men being empowered to do things, because we know men are empowered to do things in relation to women. And all of this agency and empowerment, it's always about women doing horrible things. So having agency or empowerment to work in a strip club or a brothel, or to be naked at your father's orders because you are not carrying out the orders that he gave about what you do with your body and your sexuality. So, excuse me, I think she's the absolute opposite of empowered. No one can know what she's thinking. And I suppose, you know, if I was having to ride naked through town because my father disapproved of my body and my sexuality, I might kid myself for that horrible moment that this was great for me. I think it definitely would be a bit of a psychological ruse I was pulling on myself.
But I admire your attitude. I like that attitude. Anybody else? Sorry, Mike.
Well, there was a thing recently, a story in, I think it was Pakistan, where a girl was made to walk through the town naked as a punishment.
Yes, absolutely.
Still happens.
Linda.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree completely. And one story that we haven't mentioned, which is really important to this, is Adam and Eve and the expulsion from paradise. Mm. Her nudity is shameful, and therefore the only way that, you know, the crowd deals with that, and the only way she can be pure, and I heard, you know, you can hear that in the music, is by no one looking. Because for her to be seen naked is shameful. And that's the point of the Peeping Tom character. It's Susanna and the elders. It's to be seen introduces shame. And it's when Eve realizes that she's naked that, you know, that shame of taking the apple and the inevitable expulsion from paradise. It's a Christian myth too. I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Yes, which is then overturned, of course, because Folco says,
but it doesn't
this is
end
nothing.
Well.
It does not end well, but he does at least get a chance to sort of say, no, you should not be ashamed. You should glory in this. Before they both die. If nobody else has anything else to say, I think we should perhaps wind it up, go next door. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, James. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Donald. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Julie. Thank you, everybody else.
Thank you, Annie.